This is The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing. I'm Dan Benchman, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Jeffrey Zeldin.
Hey, Dan.
The Big Web Show is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. MailChimp serves more than 300,000 users and 20 million emails daily, and their template language makes it dead simple to code HTML emails that give your clients the ability to adjust colors, fonts, and more without breaking a layout or having to mess with your code. Sign up free and see why everyone's switching to MailChimp. Check them out at MailChimp.com.
We have today the man who made the internet safe for usability. Jared Spool is the founding principal of User Interface Engineering, and it's a leading research, training, and consulting firm specializing in website and product usability. He also runs an amazing conference called UIE. Actually runs several conferences through User Interface Engineering, and I bet he will tell us about them later. He's the top-rated speaker at pretty much everywhere in the world that he goes. He's a very popular at an event apart, and I was just at a conference earlier this week. I was speaking at the University of Pennsylvania, Penn State, and Penn State, not University of Pennsylvania. And Jared had been there, and they were still talking about him. It was sad. I was giving a talk, and they were still talking about Jared, how good Jared had been 4 or 5 years earlier. So he's quite remarkable, and I think our goal in this show is just to take it easy and not do anything and just let Jared do all the work. So, Jared, what have I left out of your biography? I'm sure I did. You've had a lot.
I that whole thing about the sheep isn't true, it turns out.
Okay. Good to know.
But, just for you, in honor of your Penn State visit, I'm not wearing any pants.
Excellent. And rather than people getting the wrong idea, although it's fine if they do, why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Because there was a lovely set of tweets talking about how you neglected to bring your pants to Penn State.
It's true. I did have shorts though, so that's good. And for our for our British listeners, by shorts I mean short trousers. I don't mean So that was good. So I had a suit and shorts. Not a good combination. So,
but it worked. It's something. It seems like you could have pulled off. But how was it, Jared? Were you in attendance to the talk?
No. We were actually in the same state, but not in the same city. He was up in State College, and I was in Philadelphia, and we were holding our UIE Web App Masters Tour. Thanks for giving me that opportunity to pitch that.
I would have attended that if I hadn't been speaking at the other. I was really looking forward to it. And then I was looking
at Well, Jeffrey, you could still come to the one in Seattle.
Very good. Very good.
Which is going to be July 12th and 13th. And by the way, today is the deadline to save $100 on that if you go to uietour.com.
You're going to do anything special for our listeners out there? Maybe an extra couple bucks off or free pair of pants?
Yes, we will have a free pair of pants for every Big Web Show. In fact, it will be Jeffrey's pants. The reason he didn't pack them was because I'd stolen them.
Is there a discount code that listeners could take advantage of?
No, if they just register today, they'll save $100. That's the deal.
Oh, no code needed.
No Very code nice. Needed.
Yeah. What happens at your conference?
Everyone comes on stage fully dressed. And we've got a fabulous, fabulous group of folks. In fact, it was really an excellent show this time, and it will be again in Seattle, I'm sure. Steven Anderson, that seems to be one of everybody's favorites, is he talks about what he calls designing with play and designing seductible interfaces, and he actually shows how the types
seductive
of things
or seducible
seductive interfaces
seductive play. Good.
Yeah, and
I don't want to seduce my interface. I want it to seduce me.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. The idea behind what he's talking about is really interesting. It's what he does is he shows a lot of examples of how you can change people's behaviors by making things more playful. And And he actually has the entire audience work on techniques for making email more playful. You know, for instance, if the goal of email was to keep your inbox low, you know, giving people points, or he has the whole class sort of brainstorm on different ideas, and he's created this really cool deck of cards with different ways, like putting scarcity in, or creating collectible sets, and different things that turn out to be playful elements that people can then use to put in their design. And you see them in things like Gowalla, where they have the items that you collect, or Foursquare, where they appoint you mayor. You know, how would you take your application and get people to play with features and try things out by adding these items? The folks at Microsoft.
Brian Eno had that with a work with an artist like decades ago, had a strategies, obscure strategies.
He had a deck of cards. In fact, I bought them as a gift for an artist friend of mine at one point. They're brilliant. They're little cards that you're supposed to, whenever you get stuck, you're supposed to just go in and pull a card out of the middle of the deck and say, oh, and the card says, said something
do the
like,
opposite
remove
something essential.
Yeah, right?
So
yeah.
If he gets stuck in the recording studio with the Talking Heads or something, he'd remove something essential. He'd take the bass track out and see what happened.
Exactly. Here, I'm going to actually summon a minion.
You can do the same thing with email, because I find writing compelling email hard. Making email fun doesn't leap to mind as something that's easy to do.
So that's what he does. He says, okay, how would we make email fun? And the whole class brainstorms using his cards. They brainstorm on how to make email fun with that. I'm actually, we have the mental cards here in the office, and I'm asking my audio producer, Brian, to bring them in here so I can show them to you, because they're really cool. And he gives them out at the conference. People get these cards, so people were, what he does, and you know, he, in his normal way of making things playful, he gives you a package where the entire package is exactly the same card. You get 13 of the same card, but everybody else has different cards, so you have to go and trade, and you get to meet people. And it was amazing seeing this audience of 130 overachievers just jump up and start trading cards and bring them in. And so
I love it, those interactive things. I don't, that's also something when I speak I don't generally do, but I love it when people do it well. I've seen you make a human bar graph. In fact, I've been one of the
yes,
pieces of data in your human bar graph at South by Southwest. You did a
so that's a presentation trick I have, which is to create human bar charts. Because, you know, you see these charts on the screen, and, you know, these PowerPoint or Keynote charts, and they're okay. But it's something when you actually see how that, and you say, okay, so we surveyed all these people, and this is how their data worked out. And it shows, oh, yeah, they really love this, and they really hate that, right? Okay, so that's one thing. But it's a different thing if you actually get people to represent it. So I started doing this. I was teaching a class at Tufts University. I taught there for 19 years, a class on engineering management, design management for engineers. And I started doing this where I give them this, what's called an engagement survey. It's a thing that's actually put together by the Gallup organization, and they have these great questions, and the questions produce a number from -11 to +11, and they're basically, do you agree with these statements, the statements are things like, would you buy from this brand again, or would you recommend them to a friend? So they're sort of your store net promoter stuff. But they also get into things like, if I had a problem, I know the brand would take care of me, or if I believe, you know, that I am proud to be someone who buys from this brand, right? So, you know, all the people who wear Nike logos or tattoo Harley Davidson to their arm and then the sort of highest level ones are things like, you know, if the brand disappeared tomorrow, I'd be truly sad. And you can think about like your favorite restaurant. If that disappeared tomorrow, you'd be truly sad. So anyways, I asked, or
my iPhone.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so I give people these surveys in the audience and I have them fill them out and come up with their numbers. And then in the middle of the presentation to demonstrate how the numbers work, I actually have put markings on the stage that represent minus 11 to plus 11. And I have people stand in front of those markings and I'll have 40 or so people do it. And so the first one I'll do is like, Starbucks, and then I'll do McDonald's, and you see the whole audience move around, and then I'll do, Apple, and you know, at an organization like South by Southwest, everybody on the Apple will all be in the high positive numbers, and then I say Microsoft, and then the whole crowd sort of shifts to the left, to the negative numbers. And it's really funny. It's really telling when you see everybody move. It's almost as telling as when you see them, just basically, you know, just little dots on the screen or where they end up. It's just as telling to just see them all move, because, you know, when you go from the Apple to the Microsoft one, the crowd just basically inverts, because all the people who didn't like Apple like Microsoft and vice versa. But then the whole crowd moves to the left towards the negative numbers. So even the people who like Microsoft don't like it as much as the Apple people liked Apple. And that just becomes really real all of a sudden. And it's a lot of fun to do. It's a great exercise.
That sounds like not only an interesting thing to do on stage, but a really great way to bring data to life, maybe for a client. Is this something, when you're doing research with clients, that you would ever – do you have kind of ways of getting them to be – I mean, we should start by saying what it is that you do. When you're not on stage, when you're not writing blog posts or with like what you've been doing for 20 years and articles, or when you're not on stage being, you know, charming and funny and, you know, full of knowledge, what is it that you do? What do you do with clients and how do you engage clients in research so that they don't just, you know, so I guess that's two questions. I could come up with a third, so I'll stop.
Yeah. So I guess when I'm on stage not being charming and funny, we would call that speaking. But
okay.
That's a different
thing. When you're not speaking, what do you do?
Yeah. Actually, before I just wanted to say, Brian finally brought in, he got back from lunch and brought in the cards. These are the mental model cards, or mental note cards, I'm sorry, mental notes that Steven Anderson put together. And you can see them. This one here says feedback loops. And it says, persuasion, we are engaged by situations in which we see our actions modify subsequent results. And he talks about this. He talks about how when you see how much weight you're losing, or when you have something that tells you, like there's a site out there called Sugar Stats, where diabetics can put in their sugar counts, and they can track their going, that actually changes your behavior. And so what feedback loop could you put in to email? And one of the things that came up in the discussion was that somebody came up with was you could count how many misspellings you have, or you could actually go on a campaign to write shorter emails and give you more. Tell you at the end of the day, you wrote, you know, 40 emails that had four sentences or less. Good job, you know, and give people a feedback loop. And so anyways, that's what I was wanting to talk about there. But you had asked me about what I do with my day. And
yeah, when you're not speaking, what do you do and how do you engage with clients?
So we're a research company. So most of what we do is research. We go out and we study how to build better products, better designs, and then figure out how to bring that to designers. Because I love my iPod. I love Netflix. I think these are absolutely amazing services. They have proven in the marketplace to be very business successful services, and the experience that people have using these things is really quite amazing. And I'm of the belief that every designer could be design what they're working on right now could be a Netflix or an iPod or whatever your favorite experience service is. And so we're researching what it takes to do that. What would it mean for someone to actually be that way? And so we go out and we do a lot of research projects to do that. And then when we engage with clients, we're basically sharing what we've learned so that they can bring to their organizations how to do that. So we for instance, one of the things we found is that's very important is to have what we call an experience vision, which is a vision that talks about 5 years from now, what is the experience of using your design going to be like? And so we're working with a lot of organizations right now to build those visions and to get that understanding, because it turns out the teams that have that five-year vision are far more successful at creating great experiences than the teams that are just thinking minutes out.
And what is an experience vision?
Well, it's basically an answer to the question, what will your design be like? What will the experience of using your design be like 5 years from now?
So How granular is it? How detailed is it?
That's going to depend on what you're building. It turns out that the best teams actually have lots of little visions that are that make up the whole. So it's they're usually when they're rendered in some artifact, we call that an envisionment. So the envisionment is a video or a story or a comic strip. A lot of people use comic strips. That talks about what that experience is, and it comes down to this basic idea, right? I do this with audiences. I'll take an audience of a few hundred people, and I'll say, okay, here's what I want you to do: take out a piece of paper and write down in bullet point form what is the story of Hansel and Gretel, right? And spend a minute doing that. So they do that. They write it down. And then I say, okay, compare it to your next door neighbor and see if you basically got the same bullets. And raise your hand if your bullets are pretty much the same, you know, like 80% the same as the person sitting next to you. And almost everybody will raise their hand, right? Everybody knows the story of Hansel and Gretel. And everybody knows it in bullet point form, even though I can pretty much guarantee that none of those people had ever talked about it to each other up until that point, right? That never occurred. And then, you know, when I'm working with clients, I'll do that exercise and I'll say, okay, now let's do that with your product. Write down what the experience of using your product is going to be like 5 years from now in bullet point form, and then compare it with the person next to you. And they all look at me like I've just asked them to write their resignation letter.
Or give birth to a whale.
Exactly. Yes. Or both. The reality of it is that we don't talk about what we're going. And you can think of a vision as a stake in the sand, right? It's got a huge flag sticking out of it. And it's on the horizon. We can't get there today or tomorrow, but we can see it. It's clear. And not only can I see it, but you can see it. And Dan can see it. And all of us can see it. And even though we're in completely different places, we can all move towards it. We can tell if any baby step is getting us closer to that vision or farther away. And therefore, we can all converge on it one little baby step at a time.
That makes so much sense. Let me ask you this. If we want to make the big web show into Dancing with the Stars in 5 years.
That would be so awesome.
Where do we start?
Well, I think you need to elaborate what that vision is, right? I mean, is it just to be like Dancing with the Stars, or is it going to be something even better, right? So that the first thing, and what we focus on is not what the show will be like. So we wouldn't talk about the technology. We wouldn't talk about what the screens would look like. We wouldn't even talk about what the business model would be. What we would talk about is what is the experience that a big web show listener is going to have. So how is that different from today? So when we work with clients on this, the first thing we have to do is go out and find out what the experience is like today. Because most of our clients, if not all, practically all of them, don't really have a good handle on what today's experience is like. What is it really like to be a customer of this company? What is it really like to be?
So pretty we go clearly out. When you use websites, you can see that the people who run the websites often aren't thinking about the users at all.
Yeah, we always have this experience. It's like, oh my God, don't these people use this thing? I mean, why would they put up with this? And so we do just that, right? So we go out, we research it, we spend time. We actually go out into people's offices and homes, and we watch them do what they do, and then we see what their experience is currently like. And then from there, what we do is we take that and say, okay, today's experience was really frustrating. What would an experience be like if we eliminated all that frustration? What would be different? And if we made it really delightful, what would be different? So now we've removed frustration, we've added delight, and that becomes what we call our aspirational experience. It's what we aspire to. And then we say, okay, how would we tell that story for our users? So we actually create what we call personas, which are representations of our users that are manageable, because if you try and build it for everybody, you get into this craziness where it's like, but we have a guy who walks around with a parrot on his shoulder. What are we doing for the guy with the parrot on his shoulder? Well, we can handle parrot guy, you know, and so you reduce all the idiosyncrasies that actual individuals have down to a collection of meaningful attributes that you can design to. And then you design to that. And then so we take the personas, and all those personas actually have scenarios. So we look at the persona and the scenarios, and those become our actors and our script in the vision that we're going to put together. And then we go off and craft an envisionment. We make a video, or we do a comic strip, or we write a little short story. And in all of those things, we've now created this thing. And then the important part is to get that into the head of the team, because we haven't succeeded until they can write down the bullet points and have the exact same bullet points as everybody else, just like we can do that with Hansel and Gretel.
So, do you engage in after engagements? In other words, I'm assuming at some point...
We usually just smoke at that point.
but here's what I'm thinking. At some point, obviously, this is going to translate into wireframes. At some point, it's going to translate into... you know, test pages in HTML, you'll do some usability tests. Eventually it's a website. You then come back to these clients and say, and you know, after the site's been up for 6 months, and help them understand how to refocus or what's succeeding, what's not, all that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Once we start working with clients, we tend to work with them for a really long time.
Ah.
So because we're not actually doing the work. One of the things I realized a long time ago is the less we do, the more we can charge for it. So we don't actually do anything.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's very lucrative.
I've got a question for you, Jared. Coming in from the chat room. Let's see. Well, there's a few of them in here, but Doug Logan asks, what does Jared think of this new do-it-yourself user testing service, like things like usertesting.com? Do those things have a place?
Yes. I think they have a place just next to the penis enlargement sites.
So I take it you don't like them very much.
Asked me about what I like about penis enlargement sites.
I mean, I think, you know, some of the people are saying, they're saying something like user testing has to have a place, you know, especially in a case, and this is a quote from Doug Logan in the chat room, especially in a case where a client doesn't think they need to do usability testing and won't pay for it at all. I mean, isn't it better than nothing, or does it set up the wrong kind of dynamic?
No, it sets up the wrong kind of dynamic, because the problem with the user testing site is that if they're not going to pay for usability testing, then they don't see the value in it. Because usability testing by itself is not very expensive. Compared to all the things they pay for money for today, usability testing is really very, very expensive. Because to conduct a usability test, all you have to do is sit next to someone and watch them use it. You want to get as close to a real user as you can. But if you're building something that is sort of general purpose in life, it's something that anybody could use, you can just do that. And you literally do this in coffee shops. We've done this where we've gone into coffee shops or we've gone into public libraries and just asked people sitting at the table, say, hey, can we have 5 minutes of your time and watch you do something? And so that's not very expensive. The problem with user testing .com style stuff, and it's not just usertesting.com. I mean, it's a fabulous service if you have money to burn. But you know, if you have money to burn, I've got a backyard and a match, and I'd be more than happy to burn it for you. It's a service we offer. The thing is that there's the real value in usability testing is actually watching someone use the design, because when you're watching someone use the design, you're seeing your design through their eyes. And if you try and sub that out, if you go to usertesting.com, or even if you hire a company like us to do the usability testing for you, we won't do that, right? We won't go off and conduct 15 usability tests and then come back and write you a report and present it. We won't do that, because outsourcing your usability testing is like outsourcing your vacation. It gets the job done, but it doesn't actually return any value to you. And that's really the key thing here. The value comes in sitting in your office 2 weeks later, looking at what you're thinking of changing in the design of the site, and saying, I don't think Mary could use this. I don't think Mary is going to be able to figure this out. And the only way you're going to know what Mary can or can't do is because you spent an hour or 2 hours sitting next to Mary, realizing who she was and what was easy for her and what wasn't. And that's really what's key. It turns out that the real value in usability testing is getting everybody on the team to have basically a minimum of 2 hours every 6 weeks of exposure to people using the site. Doesn't matter if it's one person for 2 hours or four people for half an hour, but 2 hours every 6 weeks of exposure, sitting there watching them actually use the design. If you do that, you will get a much better show. Two hours, 6 weeks, you're not talking about a huge amount of expense here. And you're gonna see a tremendous amount of payback from it. So, and if you're not willing to do that, then just make it work so that you know you like it, and leave it at that. And just hope there's a lot of people out there who are just like you, who can do that.
Which works if you're 37 Signals or Steve Jobs.
Right. One of the people in the chat room is actually asking, how do you reconcile a company like Apple who does absolutely no user testing whatsoever? And yet they still seem to do a good job on many fronts. Are they an enigma the way that they're an enigma across the board?
No. Usability testing is, and by the way, it's usability testing, not user testing. We're not testing the user. We're testing the design. So I tend to not like the phrase user testing because people keep implying, and it really actually, when you say that to a participant in a study, it really unnerves them. It's like, oh, I'm being tested? I don't want to be tested, right? And we're not testing them. We're testing the design. They're helping us learn about the design. So that's it's a subtle but key distinction. Words do matter. But the usability testing, conducting user research, formal user research, is only one way to get the kind of feedback that you need. Apple, when you think about the iPhone, all of the designers of the iPhone have phones, at least until they lose them in a bar. And yeah, poor Gray Powell, right? When I'm getting my iPhone 4, I'm actually naming it Gray Powell. I think hundreds of people are going to name the phone Gray Powell.
That's
the poor guy that lost the phone or had it
Gray
stolen.
Gray Powell is the patron saint of losing crap in bars.
Was he intoxicated? He must have been.
He was extreme. It was his 28th birthday. The poor sod. It was his 28th birthday. The rumor is that he didn't quite lose it as much as it was lost on him, as it sort of was procured by someone who then sold it to Gizmodo for $10,000. $5,000 up front, $5,000 when they announced. Isn't that a nice deal?
Yeah, he is. He's still there.
He is. Okay, so the best thing about the Great Powell story, since we've gone down this road, is like a week after it came out, and Gizmodo actually published whose phone it was and put his pictures up. I mean, it was really awful that they went and outed this guy, yeah? And so within a week of that, the folks at Lufthansa USA, because the place where he lost it was the German beer garden in Cupertino. Right, he was celebrating his 28th birthday at the German beer garden, and that's where he lost it. And that story came out and made the New York Times. Jon Stewart talked about it on the Daily Show. It was a big deal, right? So Lufthansa USA comes out and twitters that they've created an open letter and they would like people to help get it to Gray Powell. And the letter says, "Dear Gray Powell, we hear you like German beer, and we've heard you've had a rough week. So we would love it if you could be our guest to Oktoberfest. We will put you up in Munich, fly you there free, and you can have as much German beer as you want." I thought, what a brilliant campaign.
Brilliant.
So we were talking about usability testing at Apple.
Does this get into the realm of genius design?
Well, it does. It's more self-design, right? Because they're all cell phone users. Before the iPhone came out, they all had cell phones. And even with the iPhone, they all have the current ones. And they're saying, what's the phone experience I want? And they design something for them. And it's not just Steve Jobs. They each design for themselves, but then they also know they have to go explain why they made that design to Steve. You know, everybody at Apple sort of lives in this constant fear of Steve's going to pop into my office any moment and maybe explain this. And so they always are thinking, you know, how am I going to rationalize this design decision to Steve? And so that's how they're designing. And so they're not doing formal usability testing. They are doing informal testing that is basically on themselves and their friends and their family members, and they're spending a lot of time taking it. And so for phones,
and on Steve, so they've got a master user named Steve.
Exactly. And Johnny Ives and all these people, right? So absolutely, and that's the way the organization thinks. And so that's why Apple is really great at things like iPhones. But Apple would not be very good, and I don't think they'd even claim to be very good, at a system that would be used for doing blood test lab requests in the neonatal infant care unit at a major hospital, right? That's not their thing, and they don't have experience with that, and they would have to go off and do research to find out what it's like to be someone who works in the NICU at a hospital and what the issues are, and to take that and make it work. That would require real research. And so the reason that Apple can get away with not doing testing is because they're designing for themselves. And 37signals can get away with this because they're designing for themselves. And that is absolutely critical to the success of their products, as long as there's an audience that's like them that's big enough. And Apple has an audience that's long enough. But there are people who don't like iPhones, and so they're not designing for those people. And there are people who don't like 37signals products. And 37signals is for, you know, it's not for you. If you want features that we don't have and we don't think should go into it, we're not designing for you. There are lots of other products. Go use one of those other products. And so... Yeah.
So is your advice then, Jared, to start out by designing for yourself, or only if you can identify that you are a member of this audience that you know is going to be bigger and there are enough people out there? Where do you start? In other words, where do you start? When does usability testing play into it?
You have to decide if the audience is like you enough, that's big enough, that you can survive, right?
It's interesting. Just for a second, it's interesting because like I started a list apart because I didn't like the web design magazines that were out there. I thought I could do a better job, and whether I did a better job or not, there was a certain kind of content that I wanted to read, so I started finding other people, writing some of it myself and finding other people, and you know, Jeff Veen, I think, started Typekit much the same way, and I think Dan started the big web, not the 5x5 network, because he really loved podcasts and wanted to make podcasts and wanted to see if he could support his family doing podcasts 24/7. You know, so I know that kind of stuff works.
Yeah, it does. And a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of solo entrepreneurs, a lot of small startups, they start that way. And they get really excited about this. And that's the why of what they did it. And in fact, Apple started that way.
And consulting for those kinds of clients is difficult. I think I've had the most difficult client-vendor relationships with when working with a brilliant entrepreneur who sort of had to control everything and had a hard time saying, well, you're this, you know, we've hired you as experts, so I'm going to trust you. Because ultimately, he couldn't.
That's right. Because trust in that environment comes, it's what we call an opinion war, right? And opinion wars can never be won. An opinion war happens when I strongly have my beliefs and you strongly have your beliefs and our beliefs don't match. And the thing is, my beliefs are based on my life's experience and the knowledge I've accrued and everything I've sort of done to get to this point. And your beliefs are on your life's experience and everything you've learned and how you've gotten to where you are in your life. And since we've had very different lives, we naturally have different experiences. And we can't reconcile that. In order for me to trust you, I actually have to throw out everything I know and just go with you, which I don't know. And that's really, really hard to do and practically impossible and practically never works. And so what we've done is instead we've looked at saying, okay, how do we get to a common ground? How do we find out what we both believe? And that's where a lot of research can come in handy. That's why user research is really quite useful. It turns out that what we can do is say, okay, what I believe isn't that important as a designer. What you believe as the client, you've got some really good ideas and opinions, and we're going to take that into account. But really, if this thing is going to be successful, we have to make sure we know what the customer believes and what they need. And where it matches what you and I believe, we're not even going to have much of a conversation. We're just going to go with that. Where it doesn't match, we're going to have to make a decision. Do we do what's in our gut and from our experience, or do we rejigger our gut to match what the customers need? And that's really key. And you mentioned genius design before, and genius design comes in when we've checked our gut so much against the data that we're almost always right. And so we don't have to go out and do the research anymore because we've done this so many times, we know how to do it.
Like people who specialize in a particular kind of client work, like design university websites, and if I'm a person who only designs university websites and I have a company that only designs university websites, there's a whole lot of stuff that we just know, right?
Right.
So we can certainly do the research to support it, or if the university doesn't agree with us, but we might have other ways of persuading the university to agree with us that have nothing to do with research, just because we kind of know how these things work out.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right.
How do you establish a usability test for a new web client? Was a question early on in the chat room, and I'd like to just make sure we don't lose it.
Yeah,
How do you establish a new usability test for a new web client?
So one of the not so secret secrets of our work, right, is that we learned a long time ago that you shouldn't actually sell usability testing to clients. You should sell you should sell to them learning about who their customers are, right? One of the most expensive usability testing projects, all it was usability testing. We conducted dozens of usability tests. The project was a $750,000 project for a large e-commerce retailer.
Amazon.
I'm not saying. we tested like 90 shoppers shopping for things like digital cameras and laptops, and we actually were paying for them to buy these items. So we were paying people $1,200 to buy a laptop or $400 to buy a digital camera, things like that. And There were 95 of these folks. The budget for paying the participants was $95,000. That's how big it was. That's what we were giving out. And we were watching them go through the whole shopping process, research and coming to the site and buying it and actually getting it and opening the package. We were seeing the whole thing. And we learned a tremendous amount of stuff. The project ended up earning the company hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue. Almost $1 billion worth, actually. But the
It's getting harder and harder to guess what company you might be talking about.
No, it's, you still can't. I bet you can't. But the thing is that the deal is that it was a 14-page proposal and never mentioned the phrase usability testing in it once, even though it was that's all it was usability tests. And the reason is because when you're dealing, particularly with executives, when you're dealing with them, they only care about five things, right? They only care about increasing revenues. That's the first thing. Decreasing profits. Increasing new customers. Yeah.
Increasing profits, right?
I'm sorry. Decreasing costs. I'm sorry. You're right. Increasing revenues, decreasing costs. That's how you get more profits. Yeah, you're right. You caught me. Oh, man, you're paying attention to what I say. Stop that. Where was I? Increasing revenue, decreasing costs, increasing market share of new customers, increasing business from existing customers, and the one that's a little harder for people to get their head around, which is increasing shareholder value, which is basically talking to the long-term value of what you're trying to do. So those are the five things they care about. So if you want to get a client to do something, anything, talk in those terms. Don't talk in terms of we're going to conduct 45 usability tests. Talk in terms of we're going to figure out what your customers aren't doing today that if we can get them to do, you will get more revenue from them. Or what's preventing your new customers from actually becoming customers? What's preventing people who come to the site from actually purchasing, right? We're going to enlarge your market share as a result. And that's what you need to talk about. There's only five things. It's easy to remember them, or you would think, except I couldn't get them right. But that's it. That's really it.
Where is this German beer garden in Cupertino?
I think you have to look it up in Google Maps.
Now, Jared, we've got to wrap this up. But there's one thing that's been on my mind as I've been listening to this. One of the main points I think that people hopefully will take away from this is that it's important, even if there isn't much budget, or even if they don't have any budget at all, that it's important for them as individuals to try as hard as they can to do at least basic user testing. Put the website in front of the people who are going to be using it every day. What is the best way for them to start, so that the people who are listening to this now, who are all pumped up about doing some usability testing and they want to actually do it, what's something they can do? How do they approach usability testing without the kind of experience that you have, just the regular designer, the regular person who wants to make their site better and easier to use?
Good.
The best way to do this is very simple. Just find someone, anyone. It can be a cousin. It could be somebody you meet sitting at the gate at the airport. Find someone and just ask them if you can have a few minutes of their time, and then sit and watch them use the design. Right, Yogi Berra once said, "You can observe a lot by watching," which is brilliant. But of course, he also said that when you come to the fork in the road, you should take it, which I'm still working on. The key thing is, if you watch them, and by watching I mean sitting and watching, and not showing them how to use it, not explaining to them why you did it the way you did it. When they get frustrated, not really helping them, you really sort of want to watch them struggle for a little bit and feel that pain, and it's really painful to feel that pain, but just say, pretend I wasn't here. How would you do this? And if you were to do that, you would see a tremendous amount of stuff. I mean, the hard part is actually not just going and redesigning everything at that moment, but sitting and seeing if that's the only person with that problem, or if in fact it happens a lot. And just, that's mostly an issue of priorities.
Just not helping is kind of hard. Just sitting there and not helping.
Not sitting there, not helping, not explaining, not, you know, just wondering. But yeah, you know, I have been in so many situations where people have been watching their users for the first time, and they go, "Oh, of course," you know, and they slap their forehead. You know, what happens is you need to really experience what it's like to use your design through somebody else's eyes. And if you can do that, if you can see it through their eyes, then you're going to have this new realization that the things that you have in your head, all those connections of how the wireframe works, all those things, they don't have that advantage. And because they don't have that advantage, you haven't, in the design, given them the clues they need to actually do the things that you want them to be able to do. And as a result, it really is an enlightening experience.
Jared, thank you so much for being on the show this time around. Jared, it was great to have you. Hopefully we can...
So before we go, Dan, I just want to say I went off and talked while we were doing this, I got a little distracted. I talked to my event manager, and she told me that there is a discount. If you use the promotion code JTALK, J-T-A-L-K, for Jared Talks, apparently that's what all I do these days. You will
and what's
get
the URL
at uietour.com. You will get $200. You will get $200 off the regular rate starting tomorrow, because that starts tomorrow, or $100 off the early bird rate, which is today. So that'll get you registration for $795. It'll save you an additional $100.
Fantastic.
Off the registration. So you can register today or starting tomorrow. It'll get you the rate at $795. Jay Talk.
Thanks so much.
Fantastico.
Yay!
Thanks again to my co-host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and to our guest, Jared Spool of User Interface Engineering, UIE.com. Thanks also to our sponsor, MailChimp.com, for making this show possible. And thanks to you for listening. Now you can directly help support 5x5 and your favorite shows by becoming a member and get a cool t-shirt in the process. Go to members.5x5.tv to learn more. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating the show on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. See you again next week.